My friends, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and it's going to be a kind of nepotism sort of show today. I write and am an editorial assistant for antiwar.com, and both of my guests today are also writers for antiwar.com. First up, Aaron Glantz, and second, in the second hour, we'll be talking again with Gordon Prather about the Non-Proliferation Treaty and Iran and that kind of thing. So first up, let me introduce Aaron Glantz. Does the news. He's a reporter for Pacifica Broadcasting and also for the Christian Broadcasting Network. He writes for IPS, the Interpress News Service, and also for antiwar.com. And he's the author of a new book called How America Lost Iraq. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Good to be with you.
And today is the second anniversary of the fall of Baghdad, right?
That's right. And we were just talking earlier before we went on air about this giant demonstration in the center of Baghdad today at Paradise Square, which is the same place where the statue of Saddam was toppled 2 years ago today. The protest is being led by the cleric Muqtada Sadr, the Shia figure, fairly well known, respected by some, disliked by others, but certainly a major political figure in Iraq who the Americans tried to take out. A year ago, in the same square where you have tens of thousands of people demonstrating for the end of the occupation, the Americans banned anyone from entering the square. And actually, I was there at the time, and I saw the Americans pulling down posters of Muqtada Sadr in that square a year ago today. So it's interesting to see tens of thousands of people in that same square calling on the Americans to leave.
Do you know how many tens of thousands it is?
I haven't gotten an accurate number from looking at the press reports here, but that's what they say. If you look at the photographs, they're wide boulevards coming into this square where there's a large mosque on one side and there's a Palestine hotel on the other side, and behind that the Tigris River. You see these main streets like Sadoun Street and Karada Street. These are main boulevards in Baghdad, and they're just choked with protesters. It's not clear how many of them are actually followers of Sadr, who is kind of a more fringe Shia figure, but like I said, also with millions of followers throughout the country. But they're also carrying photographs of Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who is more widely respected by the Shia majority in Iraq, and who has for a long time been calling he's spoken out against the occupation, but his main focus has been calling for democratic elections in Iraq. Those elections happening January 30th, the parties that he supported coming to power. And, now the question is, how are these people that Sistani, backed and were elected, how are they going to relate with the American occupation authority? Are they going to do business with them, or are they going to ask the Americans to leave? Now we have some indication that these parties, they've dropped the demand for a timeline for U.S. withdrawal, which was in their campaign. They've dropped that now. So it may be that these supporters of Sadr are, they're carrying the pictures of Sistani in order to show that they're watching him as much as they are to say that they're supporting him.
Yeah, it sounds like he's already learning American politics pretty quickly, right?
Well, I mean, the important thing to remember is that, as was pointed out to me earlier this week, I'm just in D.C. this week covering the Congress as they prepare to add $80 billion more for the occupation. It was pointed out to me that there's kind of a structural situation here, which is that now that these Shia religious parties have been elected to power, the U.S. military is now almost their proxy army.
I'm sorry, hold it right there, and we'll be right back after this break. It's the Weekend Interview Show.
We'll be right back.
right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and my guest is Aaron Glantz. He writes for Antiwar.com, the Interpress Service, does radio broadcasts for Pacifica, and is author of the new book, How America Lost Iraq. And I'm sorry that I cut you off there. We were running up against a hard break. And you were, I think, beginning to speak to the Americans as a proxy army for the new government. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, basically, the Bush administration has said that they're willing to support whoever the Iraqi people elect. Now they've elected these Shia fundamentalist parties. Fundamentalist parties have taken power, and now they're like, why should we ask the Americans to leave? The Americans will fight the people that are resisting our government. So it's a very complicated situation there, and that's why I say that the Sadr movement, you know, many people in the Sadr movement may have voted, and in fact, there are people in the Sadr movement who were part of this United Iraqi Alliance. You know, one of the reasons they may be carrying the poster of Sistani is to remind him of the pledges that this United Iraqi Alliance, the Shia religious slate, made, you know, to ask for a timeline, demand a timeline for an end of the occupation.
And that United Iraqi Alliance is the party that's led by Ibrahim Jafari, who's going to be the new prime minister, right?
Well, the United Iraqi Alliance is an alliance of a whole bunch of Shiite religious parties. It includes the Dawah Party, which means the kind of Islamic proselytizing party of Ibrahim Jafari. It also includes another organization that's very large called the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which is led by Abdelaziz al-Hakim, who is the main guy on television for them during the campaign. But since he's a religious he's an imam himself. The Americans wouldn't have accepted him as the prime minister. He's lived for the last 20 years before the war in Iran and has gotten a lot of financial support from the Iranian government. And then smaller parties, including Sadr's political parties, although the Sadr movement itself was split, and some of them called the election a fraud. Others participated as a way to end the occupation.
How close are the Dawah Party and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution?
Well, I mean, basically, they're promoting some very similar ideas. I think, if anything, you could say that the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq is something that has traditionally been more associated with the Iranian government, and some people are skeptical of them because, you know, for example, they have a militia called the Badr Corps. This militia was trained in Iran. But then again, the Dawah Party, I mean, you have to remember that what happened in the 80s when America was backing Saddam was that tens of thousands of Shia who believed in Islamic Revolution, in terms of what Ayatollah Khomeini had done in Iran, they were rounded up and killed. And after that, the political leadership of both of these parties, you know, fled to Iran. Although at some point in there, Jafari got sick of the Iranian government, and he himself went to London and became the London representative of the Dawah Party.
And when you speak of that purge, that was the same one where Murtada al-Sadr's father was killed, correct?
Well, actually, that's not true. That's actually the same purge that Murtada al-Sadr's uncle was killed. Murtada al-Sadr comes from a very important political family in Iraq, a very important religious family in Iraq. And, you know, this is one thing that I think that we have to be very aware of whenever we see American officials on television saying that they're, you know, rounding up a terrorist or a fundamentalist. I mean, you have to remember that most of these people, they have history, they have followings, and Murtada al-Sadr's family is particularly prominent. His uncle, whose name is Ayatollah Muhammad Bakr al-Sadr, he is the author of two of the most important Islamic texts for the Shia in this century called Our Philosophy and Our Economy, and they kind of set the groundwork for how to create an Islamic theocracy. And when he spoke out against Saddam's regime in 1979, the same time that Ayatollah Khomeini was coming to power in Iran, he was killed. And that set off, his killing set off these this massive purge that I was talking about earlier. Then in 1999, Murtada al-Sadr's father, who's also an Ayatollah, Grand Ayatollah Muhammad Siddiq al-Sadr, when he gave the sermon that thousands of people attended, where he called You know, he urged people to rise up against pharaohs and thieves, intimidating the regime. And he and most of Muqtada, all of Muqtada Sadr's brothers were also killed. And so Muqtada Sadr, who led this massive demonstration in Baghdad today, this is his background. This is where he comes from.
And he has residual credibility from his family.
Yeah, and he also inherited his family's organization. So, you know, across the country, you know, for example, I was in Hilla, which is near Babylon, historic Babylon, and, you know, the Sadr movement there is well known because the people leading the Sadr movement in Hilla are the same people who were leading the Sadr movement when Muqtada Sadr's, you know, when his father and his uncle were leading it. So, you know, it's a grassroots national organization, you know, that survived decades of oppression by the Ba'ath regime and is now suffering the oppression of the Americans.
Okay, these protests that are happening today where effigies of Bush and Blair are being toppled and set afire in the same square where Saddam's statue fell 2 years ago, this is in response to the final... it took a while to get done, I guess, but they finally formed a government with a prime minister, a president, and two vice presidents. And I suppose this was the key to get the people out in the street saying, okay, we have a government now, you can leave. So I want to get into a little bit about the form of the new government, and if you can help us get familiar with who the characters are in the prime minister chair and in the president's chair, et cetera.
Well, as I mentioned before, the prime minister is this guy, Ibrahim al-Jafari, and he's the leader of the Dawah Party, which, as I mentioned, is the Islamic proselytizing party. It's an Islamist political party, and in 79, when it was being oppressed by the government of, it was being oppressed by the Saddam government, it was preaching something kind of like what we see now in Iran. These days they've moderated some, and now what they talk about is Islam as a source for legislation. You know, the same way that you hear people, you know, in the Christian right here in America talk about, you know, Christianity as a source for law.
But in a vague way, not an Islamist state, but an Islamic one.
Well, I mean, what we're talking about here is how do we make the laws? You know, people in America, some people in America would say, well, you know, according to the Bible, abortion is murder. Therefore, we should ban abortion. Using the Quran as a guide, Jafari will want to be doing similar things. He will want to be saying, you know, according to the Quran, you know, people who want to get divorced should get divorced in certain ways. Women should behave in certain ways. Alcohol should be very difficult to obtain. You know, especially in the arena of family law, he will push for Islamic law to be adopted. But you're unlikely to see him pushing for, you know, a system where the country is ruled by an Ayatollah the same way that we see in Iran.
Okay, what can you tell us about the new president, Talabani? He's one of the leaders of one of the factions of the Kurdish groups, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of time in northern Iraq, and he's basically, along with this other guy, Masoud Barzani, the two of them together who run the two major Kurdish political parties, they're effectively the government of about a third of the country. Once you pass Kirkuk and you keep going north, or if you go to Sulaymaniyah, which is to the east of Kirkuk near the Iranian border, you're effectively in another country called Kurdistan. All the signs are in Kurdish. If there's an Arab on a bus, the Kurdish Peshmerga guerrillas who are working as the police will pull the person off the bus. And Talabani, along with Masoud Barzani, they're the leaders of this area. And the two of them together have been fighting the Ba'athist regime, and even the, you know, Masoud Barzani's father, Mullah Mustafa Barzani, the regimes before Saddam, for Kurdish autonomy, within Iraq. Talabani himself is kind of an interesting character because, depending on what day of the week it is, he can take a different position on an issue. For example, he was, you know, working with Masoud Barzani's father, Mullah Mustafa Barzani, against the regime in the early 60s, for Kurdish autonomy, and he cut a deal with the regime in Baghdad, the Ba'ath regime, pre-Saddam Ba'ath regime, and actually attacked Barzani. Then in the 80s, he sided with the Iranian government and the Iran-Iraq war against Saddam, and that's one of the reasons that that's the main reason that over 100,000 Kurds were rounded up and killed by Saddam, was in retaliation for Talibani siding with Iran. Then the Gulf War came around, and then he decided, you know, it might be a good idea to side with America. But he didn't forget his Iranian friends, because when the Kurdistan Democratic Party of Iran, which is trying to do the same thing in Iran that he's trying to do in Iraq, when the Iranian government wanted to fly airplanes to bomb the outposts of the Kurdistan Democratic Party of Iran in his territory, you know, he said, go ahead right away, anything for my friends, the mullahs of Iran. So he's an interesting guy to watch. If it's Saturday, he must be supporting the Americans.
Right. Well, with warlords running around like this and the prevalence of tribalism and ethnic identity being so much a determinant of political factors in that land, are you in any way optimistic about the future of federalism in that country?
Well, I mean, there's a real different understanding between the Kurdish people and the Arab people in Iraq around issues of federalism. Because in Kurdistan, in the north, the only real issue is not whether or not they should have federalism, but it's actually whether they should have a kind of a federal structure within Iraq, or whether they should just quit Iraq entirely and declare independence. So the real real situation there.
Okay, we'll get back and talk more about Kurdistan with Aaron Glantz, author of How America Lost Iraq. It's the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, talking with Aaron Glantz. He writes for Antiwar.com, does radio on the Pacifica Network, and also writes for the Interpress Service. His new book is How America Lost Iraq. And Aaron, I promise we're going to talk about your book at some point during this interview. But for right now, I want to get back to Kurdistan a little bit, and the question of whether the Kurds can remain part of the nation state of Iraq under the new government, or even, as you said, they could have a federal system and just be Kurdistan. They could break off and still not be a united government, right?
Well, I mean, basically, Kurdistan is effectively another country right now, even if, on the ground, legally, even if legally it's not. Basically, it is. I mean, they have their own they have their own police, they have their own language, they run their own schools, they run their own everything. It's kind of like a Stalinist one-party state kind of thing. I mean, they had an election for the Kurdish parliament at the same time that they had an election for the national government. And one of the interesting things was that the people who wanted to choose which party to vote for in the Kurdish election, they only had one choice. All the political parties in Kurdistan, from the Communist Party to the Islamist Party to these two dominant ones, the PUK and the KDP, they all kind of had a meeting and decided how many seats each one of them was going to get. And that's how it turned out, because people only had that one option. One of the things that's kind of funny, too, is that there were a lot of, Kurdish Baathists who got elected to the Kurdish parliament as part of this unified list, because these Baathists, who actually helped exterminate the Kurds for Saddam, they have a lot of money. They benefited from the regime, and so kind of as payback for helping these dominant political parties, they were given seats in the Kurdish parliament, and there wasn't much that any regular, ordinary Kurdish people could do about it.
You say in your book that Muqtada al-Sadr has actually made a big point, being kind of the minority voice within the majority Shia, that he's made a big point of saying absolutely not to Kurdish autonomy. And that, in fact, I'm kind of confused about this. I know that there's a big confrontation over who gets to control Kirkuk because of the oil-rich land around there. But it would seem like that fight would mostly be between the Kurds and the Arab Sunni. Only from what I read, that conflict is really playing out more between the Kurds and the Shia. Can you explain that?
Well, I mean, maybe the reason that is because the Shia are dominant compared to the Sunni, I mean, you know, and even the Kurds, in dominating Iraqi politics these days, in terms of the fact that most Sunnis have opted for the armed resistance at this point, so they're not actually sitting at the negotiating table. You know, they're shooting at the people who are making these negotiations, and then that's just a fact of the situation. The Arab population in Kirkuk is mixed between Sunni and Shia. The Sunnis in Kirkuk, they've always lived there, you know, alongside Kurds and ethnic Turks. And during the Saddam period, they made up the hammer of his regime there. They made up the secret police. They made up the military who were stationed there, and so forth. There's also a lot of Shia there that were actually moved. A lot of them are from Amara in the far south, where there's a lot of support for Muqtada Sadr. And then they were moved to Kut or Diwaniya, a little bit farther north by Saddam, and eventually settled in Kirkuk as a means of trying to break Sadr and the other Shia Islamist movements back in the 70s and 80s. They were moved to Kirkuk, and the Kurds were killed as a means of putting down Kurdish nationalism. So now you have the Kurds saying, hey, wait a minute, when we were killed, Saddam moved the Shia to Kirkuk, and now we want them to go. And so you hear a lot of talk about forceful repatriation of Shia out of Kirkuk as a means of creating a Kurdish state up there. And you know, and it's no wonder that the Shia are outraged about that. And Muqtada Sadr is very followed amongst the Shia who are living in Kirkuk, and he's controlling the mosques there.
Well, and if the Kurds have total control over Kirkuk and the oil-rich land near there, and the Shia control all the oil near Basra in the south, then the Sunni are pretty much left without any oil land, right? Basically why they're fighting?
Well, I mean, there's so many reasons why people are fighting each other. I mean, but I think that there's also a fundamental different understanding between the Arabs and the Kurds that goes beyond just the issue of the oil. I mean, it is true. People say that under Kirkuk is about 6% of all the oil in the whole world. At current prices, it would probably be about $500 billion. You know, so that's definitely something not to forget about. But, I mean, the Arabs have, they've ruled Iraq for 80 years since it was drawn up by the British after World War I. And they're used to, they don't feel like the Kurds need their own country. You know, they don't get why the Kurds want to be separate. And by the same token, on the Kurdish side, you know, if you ask regular Kurds why they aren't willing to just kind of make a peace with the Arabs and let them stay, you know, in Kirkuk and not force them out now that they have more power, they have no desire to compromise at all.
This democracy is going to work out great, I can tell. It's the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We're talking with Aaron Glantz, author of How America Lost Iraq. He's got an article today on antiwar.com. We'll be right back. Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives for you in MP3 format. Weekendinterviewshow.com. You can email me, Scott at weekendinterviewshow.com or Scott at antiwar.com. I write for them, as does my current guest, Aaron Glantz. He's got an article up there on antiwar.com today called $80 Billion More for War. And his new book is called How America Lost Iraq. And you can look it up. They have it at Amazon and so forth. His name is Aaron Glantz, G-L-A-N-T-Z. So you can Google that, How America Lost Iraq. And I want to get to this book in just one second, but I got to finish up one more point here on Kurdistan, Aaron. And that is something that actually spend a bit of time on in the book. If Kurdistan is really to try to declare full independence and make itself an independent state, the Turks and the Syrians and the Iranians and all the neighboring countries that have local Kurdish populations are not going to stand for that.
Well, I mean, and they've said so a number of times. Periodically, their foreign ministers get together in one of their capitals and issue a joint statement saying they won't stand for it. But in northern Iraq, in Iraqi Kurdistan, you know, the people are less afraid of this than they used to be because they see that the Americans are going to stay in Kurdistan. You know, like, they might get kicked out of the rest of the country eventually by the resistance, but, you know, there's no resistance at all to the Americans in northern Iraq, primarily because they just stay in their bases and don't do anything. They let the Kurds take care of business. And, you know, occasionally they do something. Like, for example, in January, they quote-unquote accidentally bombed a student dormitory right in the center of the provisional capital of Erbil. And that woke a lot of people up because they don't usually experience the Americans in Kurdistan the same way people in the rest of the country do. But, you know, people figure that as long as the Americans are there, it's highly unlikely that the Turks, which have the largest army of the three countries, would do anything.
It's interesting because we've helped the Turks, our loyal allies, suppress their own Kurdish population quite violently for decades now.
Well, and that's right. And there's actually considerably more Kurdish people in Turkey. I mean, you've got 20 million Kurds probably in Turkey, and you only got about 6 million Kurds in Iraq. You know, it was all tied up in the Cold War. The Kurds in Iraq, in Turkey, sorry, you know, they were Marxists. They were getting money from the Soviet Union. You know, Turkey was a bulwark ally of America. And, you know, and these habits are hard to break after a while. But it is true. I mean, you know, when Turkey would go and bomb Kurdish villages in the southeast of their country, you know, there's a pretty decent chance that they'd be using an American F-16 fighter jet.
It's funny, you know, if I remember right, one of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points was to make an independent Kurdistan. I just thought that was funny. We're still fighting about this.
Well, he said he wanted everyone to be to, you know, all the different Ottoman peoples to be able to claim their own country, and just somehow when it got down to Kurdistan, that was forgotten about.
Yeah. Okay. Now I'm sorry because I really do want to talk about this book. It's an excellent book, How America Lost Iraq, and it's the story of your. I really actually like it because it's not so much focusing on the news and the politics and the big stories as much as it is basically you telling your story of your time in Iraq after the war. So why don't you start us off by telling us when exactly you went to Iraq and under what circumstances?
Well, you know, a lot of journalists had gone to Iraq before the war, you know, and to be there while the bombs rained down. But I didn't do that primarily because other journalists that I trusted who made the same trip, they couldn't really say anything. I mean, it was almost impossible to report under Saddam. He would just take you to, you know, the regime would take you to events that you were, you know, supposed to cover, like the election where he won 100% of the vote, or press conferences by people like his foreign minister, Naji Sabri, who would declare that, you know, the Americans would be crushed. And, you know, you couldn't talk to regular people at all. So what I was doing instead was I was hanging out in Jordan and Turkey, you know, and doing stories about how the United States, at the same time it was prosecuting its war on Iraq, was suppressing liberty in places like Jordan and Turkey by, you know, supporting the Jordanian government's move to declare a state of emergency in Jordan and, you know, begin censoring and arresting journalists and activists who spoke out against the war that was opposed by all the other Jordanian people, or the, you know, the Americans' efforts to manipulate the Turkish parliament into approving a second front on the war, you know, despite the fact that 90% of Turkish people opposed it.
Well, it's because we believe in spreading democracy.
Well, actually, you know, Paul Wolfowitz, the new chair of the World Bank, after the Turkish parliament narrowly voted you know, against allowing America to launch the invasion from its soil. He actually commented that he was very disappointed in the Turkish military for not doing its duty by intervening, as they've done at the behest of America so many times before.
That sounds par for the course.
So anyway, at that point I decided once Saddam's statue came down shortly after April 9th, 2003, you know, a friend of mine who's a French reporter and I, we just took a taxi from Amman into Baghdad and found a place to stay.
I like how in your book you say it was kind of frustrating because you're reporting for Pacifica Radio, which is obviously left-wing, progressive kind of radio, and how they didn't really want to hear any of your initial reports because they were all about how the Iraqi people were really glad to see this guy go, even if it did take an American invasion to get rid of him.
Yeah, I mean, that was the case. I mean, and people were just demoralized, you know. I mean, they had been living with the Ba'ath regime for 35 years, and, you know, a lot of domestic efforts had been made to get rid of him. I mean, we talked earlier about the uprising by the Dawa Party in 79 that was brutally crushed with tens of thousands of people rounded up and killed. We have the suppression of the Kurdish revolt where 100,000 people were killed. We have the, you know, the Sadr uprising in 99, which was stopped. And we have the 91 uprising, which the first Bush administration called for and then allowed Saddam to suppress the people and kill tens of thousands of people again. So, you know, at that point, people were saying things like, we will be very sad and angry, you know, if the Americans stay, but we're sure glad Saddam is gone. And what I wanted to do at that point was really document all the human rights abuses of Saddam, because you have to remember Iraq was a closed society, so everyone knew that, you know, Saddam was bad, but people weren't exactly sure of exactly what he did. And those stories were not so popular, it's true.
In your book, you quote some of the Iraqi people as sounding almost as naive as Americans when they talk about America's motives for being in their country. And, yeah, we're pretty sure they're going to leave now that they've got rid of the dictator. They're going to hold some elections and be gone, and we sure are thankful for them.
Well, you know, I don't think that that was the opinion of everyone. That was definitely one opinion that was being voiced. There was also a lot of, disappointment at that time because people were very upset at the looting. You know, America came in, and, you know, probably all your listeners are familiar with the fact that they guarded the oil ministry and let everything else in the capital be looted. The streets were unsafe. There was no work. There was no electricity. There was no running water. But people kind of felt like it was almost impossible for people to imagine that this situation that they were experiencing at the beginning was going to go on for 2 years. They expected that, you know, America would try to fix all the things that they broke. And it's really inconceivable to me, you know, that even in Erbil, in Kurdistan, where there's no war at all, where there's complete peace, there's still only electricity for 3 or 4 hours a day, you know, 2 years after the fall of Saddam. It's almost impossible to imagine how we could have spent, $140 billion and not achieved electricity. But now, as you mentioned, the American taxpayers will put another $80 billion for this. So this was another attitude that people were having. But another guy who actually didn't put in the book, this old communist guy, you know, and the communists, of course, enemies of the United States, and in addition to that, enemies of Saddam. And so I asked him, what do you think about the fact that America invaded Iraq? And he said, this one, meaning the Americans, we know how to deal with them. But Saddam, we couldn't deal with. So, you know, there was also a sense among some people that, you know, now the Americans had come, they were going to wait to see what would happen. If the Americans didn't leave, then they would have to kick them out. And they were more optimistic about kicking the Americans out than they were about getting rid of Saddam.
Although it seems kind of funny, if you look at all the violence that's gone on since the invasion, it seems like if all these insurgents had, and I guess this is the Sunni that are doing the fighting now who supported Saddam, but there have been this kind of trouble from his own people. Could Saddam have lasted any better than the Americans with this kind of insurgency all the time?
Well, I mean, I think that I think that this kind of insurgency was made possible by the fact that when the Americans came in, one of the things that Paul Bremer did was he dismissed the entire army. There's certainly, you know, the Saddam's military was not tremendously popular amongst the people, but at the same time, most of the people in it were regular, ordinary conscripts. And what the Americans could have done, they could have just dismissed the officer corps, which was Ba'athist, and, keep the army standing to protect the country. But instead, what they did was they dismissed the entire army and police force, and then they sent American troops house to house throughout the country, banging down doors, arresting people, taking them to Abu Ghraib, you know, and that created kind of a cycle. First you have lawlessness, then you have abuse by the American troops, and you end up with more and more violent resistance. And with the current administration we have in Washington, the only way they know how to deal with that is to turn around and round up even more Iraqis and send even more people to Abu Ghraib, which creates even more resistance, and then we have the situation that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, and then they export the tactics from Guantanamo Bay, where the rule of law doesn't apply, to Iraq, where ostensibly it does.
And yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things is that still, you know, 2 years after the start of the occupation and a whole year after the scandal at Abu Ghraib, we still, to this day, have no idea what happens to people after they're arrested by the Americans. I mean, they go to Abu Ghraib, or they go to Camp Buka, or they go to the airport. But, for example, I've been following the case of this one Kurdish guy, Ali Bapir. You know, there's not that many Kurdish people, it's called Camp Victory, the U.S. prison at formerly Saddam Hussein International Airport. But this guy, Ali Bapir, he's a Kurdish mullah, and he was on his way to a meeting with the Americans to talk about keeping peace between Kurdish Islamists and the Americans. And the Americans went and arrested him, and they took him to prison. And, you know, to this day, he's never been charged with anything. And when I called the Pentagon spokesperson in charge of detainees, and I asked him, what's going on with Ali Bapir, he said, well, we refuse to comment on specific detainees. So, there's no system. People are just held until the Americans decide to let them go.
And this is how we're losing Iraq, or how we lost it, you say in your book.
Yeah, I mean, this is what it all boils down to as far as I'm concerned. I mean, if you look at the single most important thing that the Americans did wrong since the beginning of the war was they flattened the city of Fallujah in May of in April as well of 2004, and then they went back for good measure a few months later and completely decimated whatever was left. But prior to the flattening of Fallujah, people thought that maybe there might be some redeeming quality of the occupation, that somehow the Americans, they might realize that they were behaving wrong. But after the four private security guards of Blackwater International who were guarding Bremer, after their bodies they were dragged burning through the city of Fallujah and hung from the old Fallujah Bridge in the center of town, and America went and just bombed the living daylights out of Fallujah, and they killed hundreds of innocent civilians, and all of that was shown on television in Iraq. It was all shown on Jazeera. It was all shown on Arabia. They had reporters in Fallujah, even if we didn't see it here in America. And then, of course, people have family in Fallujah, and every single one of those people, in Iraq who watched this happen, it was like the last straw. And even before that, people here in the States, they make a big deal about the Abu Ghraib pictures that came out and showed that really gross torture of prisoners, in Abu Ghraib. But people in Iraq, they knew about that because, they had brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and cousins who had been taken to Abu Ghraib and had been held incommunicado. And then a few who had been released were telling those stories. And so when America just flattened Fallujah, it was the last straw for most.
So if we did have a window of opportunity, which I should go ahead and say, at least from my own point of view, that I don't care if they're still throwing flowers and candy at us, it's still not a good enough reason for the American military to go overseas searching for monsters to destroy. So, you know, that aside, though, basically you're saying there was roughly 1 year worth of window of opportunity for the United States to make good on its promises and leave, and maybe even leave an ally behind, and that it was basically a year ago with the attack on Fallujah that that window was finally slammed shut.
I mean, and that's what I think. I mean, I think, and a number of people, I mean, I was against the war as well, and I continued to think that it was a terrible idea, but just practically speaking, I do believe that that the Americans, had they gone in, toppled Saddam, organized an election, and rebuilt the country, and then left, and been gone by now, you know, people might have elected a government that would have been pro-American, in fact. And given the Bush administration some, if not all, of the things that it wanted, but now you have a virulently anti-American population there because of the length and brutality of the occupation.
How long have you been a reporter for Pacifica?
I've been working for Pacifica for about 10 years.
Oh, really? For that long?
Yeah, I mean, before I've been working in the Middle East and covering issues of war for only a couple of years. Actually, before that, I worked for a number of years in Sacramento as the state capitol reporter, and you know, that was before Arnold.
Oh, I see. Hey, everybody, I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Aaron Glantz, G-L-A-N-T-Z. He's the author of the new book, How America Lost Iraq, and he writes for antiwar.com. Has an article up there right now, in fact. And we'll be right back to wrap up. Be right after this. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, wrapping up with Aaron Glantz. He's a reporter for Pacifica Radio and also the Christian Broadcasting Network. He writes for Interpress Service and for antiwar.com, where he has an article today called $80 Billion More for War. And his new book, How America Lost Iraq. Now, I'm sorry that we didn't get to spend too much time on the meat of the book. I have to know real quick, I'm sorry this is a stupid question, but I have to know, what is the deal with the Pepsi in this book? Either they're paying you for product placement, or Iraqis love Pepsi. What is going on?
Well, I mean, it's an issue of hospitality, really. I mean, you know, people like to think that Iraq is a dangerous place, you know, and it is. But the fact of the matter is that most people in Iraq, are extraordinarily gracious. And even the most anti-American of people, when they hear that an American journalist is coming, they want to welcome him. And of course, you know, they're not going to offer you alcohol, because it's against Islam. So, you know, you're going to have a couple of different options. You know, the most popular is tea, and then if tea is declined, Pepsi is going to be offered. And, you know, as in other countries of the Middle East, Coke is not too popular because of rumors, and I don't know how true they are. Maybe they are true, about a relationship between the Coca-Cola company and the State of Israel. So Pepsi is it's the drink of choice.
Okay. Sorry for wasting a whole couple of minutes on that, but I was very interested in that because the subject of Pepsi comes up probably 50 times in the book somewhere. But I want to ask you real quickly about Paul Wolfowitz's friend, who was the eyewitness to the cold-blooded murder of two sheiks at a meeting of the Babylon Human Rights Organization. Can you tell us that story real quick?
Yeah, you know, and I also want to say that before I tell this whole story, I want to let the listeners know that the man that was arrested at this meeting where people were organizing nonviolent protests, still to this day is in Abu Ghraib prison, and he has now been charged with the crime of murder, although the Americans have not said who exactly he murdered and when he did it. So it's kind of an odd charge.
Well, that's the American way.
Well, it is odd. I mean, at least if you're going to charge someone with murder, you should say who it is they killed, but they don't seem to have done that. What happened was is that there was a meeting of this organization called the Babylon Human Rights Organization in Hilla, which, as I said, is right near ancient Babylon. The Americans came in. They wanted a guy from the Sutter office, who they did arrest, And the reason the guy from the Sutter office was there is because, as I mentioned earlier, the movement of Muqtada Sutter, while not, you know, universally liked, is a mainstream political movement in Iraq. But this was back when they were trying to kill everyone in the Sutter movement, so they busted in to this Human Rights Association meeting. They ordered everyone down on the ground. They kicked the editor of the newsletter of the organization. They kicked him in the head, and they grabbed this guy Adnan Onabi, and they grabbed another fellow who was just happened to be reading the prayer before the meeting began, took them away to Abu Ghraib, and they also shot these two sheikhs dead in the head. When I inspected the site, I mean, I'm not a forensic, you know, cop or anything, but it was a very narrow space, and the only bullet holes were up and down the wall where the sheikhs were standing, and their pieces of their brains were on the ground.
Cool. Well, and isn't that funny? If you're in Iraq, you get charged with murder, and there's not even a body. You're the Americans, you murder whoever you want, and you get away with it scot-free. I love it. That's why the world loves America so much. Aaron Glantz, he's the author of How America Lost Iraq. Thank you very much for coming on the show today, Mr. Glantz.
It's a pleasure.
And again, he writes for antiwar.com. He has an article up there today. We'll be right back with another antiwar.com author, Gordon Prather, nuclear weapons expert. So stay tuned. It's the Weekend Interview Show.